The following interviews and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
It's time again for Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio with the latest news and conversation related to firearms and your Second Amendment rights. Sponsored by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in throughout the hour to join us, 458-8255-458-TALK. What's on your mind about firearms today? And it's another great day in Fairbanks. It's overcast, looks like it's going to snow, and the temperature is 21 degrees. Melissa is back, and she's expertly running the board for me today. Thank you, Melissa. And she keeps the Shooter's Corner archives up to date for us, so if you miss a program, it should be accessible in the archives within a day, and I appreciate that, too. So what is on our agenda today? I want to talk about the Alec Baldwin on-set shooting. And it's National Chocolate Day, so let's talk about the prominent role chocolate has had in war. And I have an article to share on the current state of Remington Ammunition as discussed by employees who have been with the company many, many years. I want to wrap up statistics from the National Shooting Sports article I spoke about last week. And I want to talk about Chuck Indereden, who is an instructor in town, and maybe Mag Lula's Up Lula's if we have time. But first, Melissa has an event to talk about and let you know. Melissa?
Yeah, so there is a drawing going on. Actually, it's a raffle. Hockey Club Fairbanks.
Okay.
A bunch of my little friends here in town who love to play hockey. They are doing a raffle to kind of support their team. Ice time, practices, tournaments, all the good things.
Yeah.
And they have decided to raffle off a Ruger Precision rifle this year. It's a
great
Winchester Magnum. $2,000 value. This gun is legit.
Okay, great.
And if anybody is interested, the drawing for it will be held November 13th. That's an Ice Dogs game at the Big Dipper that night. And so they'll be doing it there. But you don't got to be present to win. If you would like to get your hands on a ticket, if you want to be a part of this raffle, you can actually give Maria Brister a call. That's who you want to get a hold of. Her phone number is 907-378-6084. That's 378-6084. Raffle tickets are $20 a piece. Like I said, this is a pretty amazing rifle that they got that they're auctioning off. And all the proceeds going to benefit some kids who love to play hockey. So if you're interested, there's your
That sounds wonderful. Thank you. And put me down for a ticket. I will be buying one. Okay, thank you. And that phone number is 907-378-6088. So pick up a ticket and
6084.
Win. 6084.
Yep, there you go.
That's my bad eyesight. Okay, and pick up a ticket and win again. Thank you. All right. Now, by now, most of our listeners have heard that it's October 21st, actor Alec Baldwin shot and killed his on-set cinematographer, Halina Hutchins. And he also wounded his film director, Joel Souza. And I think that by now, most of you have read at least several articles about that incident, and that included purportedly what happened on stage, and maybe more articles from third parties explaining what could have been done so that the incident would never have happened. And even more articles with experts chiming in about Baldwin's culpability in the incident. And some articles have attempted to explain how a loaded gun got into Alec Baldwin's hands on the set. I suspect it won't be until the law weighs in that we will know exactly what happened and why. Was it a real period gun? Was it a reproduction of a period gun? Did someone put a live round in the gun? Did the gun contain a blank? We'll learn the details in the future. What I want to talk about today is the general case. These incidents do not have to happen. that it happened to someone who has been vocally negative about guns and gun ownership is another situation I want to talk about. So let me cover both gun safety to prevent negligent discharges and why sometimes it is the anti-gun promoters that are the very persons who cause the problem. And I will start with a quote from our NRA basic pistol textbook. And that is a sentence taken from a larger paragraph titled, A Gun Owner's Responsibilities. Quote, guns are neither safe nor unsafe by themselves. When gun owners learn and practice responsible gun ownership, guns are safe, unquote. And the term gun ownership or gun use go together in my mind. Anyone owning, using, or working in any capacity with a firearm needs to learn safe gun handling and ownership. Whose ultimate responsibility is it when a discharge happens and kills or injures another person? In the Baldwin case, so far, it looks as if there's several people in line who handled a gun without making sure it didn't have a live round in it, or any other type of projectile mimicking a live round that could hurt a bystander. But ultimate responsibility for checking and handling a gun is up to the adult responsible for ownership and use. If that gun is a single-action vintage revolver or a reproduction of a vintage single-action model, the owner and user need to understand how to check if the cylinder is empty. Any other employees or bystanders in proximity to a firearm being used, even as a stage prop, need to be properly trained in gun safety. It bothers me when I read in the Baldwin incident that he was handed the gun. It was his responsibility, as well as anyone else in that chain of handling of the gun, to individually check that gun for what type of round was in it and for any obstructions. When we teach classes, we teach students to hand off a firearm to another person, and the proper way we show them is related to the type of gun they hand off. The muzzle, of course, is always pointed in a safe direction, which is away from any person. And we teach that the first thing to do before handing a gun to another person is to check to make sure it is unloaded. And then we tell the students that the person to whom we hand off the gun to should not take our word that the gun is unloaded. He should check it himself. Never, ever trust someone else as to whether a gun is loaded, and never trust someone else as to what a gun is loaded with. Check yourself. Is it loaded? The gun should never be handed to another person loaded. But if a person attempted to hand you a loaded gun, you would stop them and have them empty it. And before you loaded it back up, you would check to make sure the ammunition you are loading back into that gun is the right type of ammunition for that gun, what it's rated for, and for what you're using that ammunition for. And this gets me back to those who rant about gun safety and who have never taken a gun safety class. And we all know these people. We have them in our own community. There's one lady in particular who occasionally writes letters to the editor in the Newsminer about gun safety, often citing erroneous statistics. I asked her once if she had ever taken a gun safety class, and her answer was no. She never did sign up for any gun safety class that I've taught with other instructors at the range. And don't you think that if someone is against gun ownership because they think guns are unsafe and they spend a great deal of their personal time espousing that idea, that those persons would be smart enough to take a gun safety class to see exactly what the problem is with gun ownership? How do they know what they're talking about? So it's difficult for me to read in the articles that initially came out on the Baldwin incident that, quote, he was handed a gun, unquote. It doesn't matter how many rules are in place, who else is trained, and who told him the gun was a cold gun. It's the end user's responsibility to check himself, no matter who else has checked that gun. And the end user must check because that is the person who bears the responsibility for whatever happens when he uses that gun. And here are a few quotes I took from several of the articles I read this last week. And as I read some of these, you will understand that the rules in place make it everyone else's responsibility except the end user, and I think that is wrong. Let's see, let's go to a break now, and I'll start these quotes after the break.
sings raggedy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in the saddle on a horse, a pretty good horse that syncopated, gaited, and there's such a funny meter to the roar of his repeater. How they run when they hear this fella's gun, because the western folks all know. Why is a highfalutin' scootin' shootin'?
Now that we're once again in the great frozen north, it's time to stay warm and be prepared for the elements. Being prepared was ingrained in me at a very early age, and Auto Trim Design can help you be prepared too. With auto starts to warm your car, heated seats to warm your buns, moose lights to show you the way, mud flaps and floor mats to protect your rig, running boards to make getting in and out of your truck less tedious, and much, much more. Get prepared today at Auto Trim Design.
As we always say, we will be here when the other guys are gone.
Arctic RV will be closed beginning November 24th and will reopen April 4th this spring, so book your shop appointments now. Your ATV and snow machine hauling trailers will be ready to roll for the season and ready for pickup on or before November 23rd. From wheel bearings to wiring to propane appliances and lights, have them all repaired at Arctic RV. Need parts? Shop Arctic RV's huge parts inventory. Get out and play with Arctic RV at 30th and Pegger Road.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Alignments protect your vehicle's steering system as it extends the life of your tires. Book yours at GCR Tires and Service, the Tire Guys, taming the Alaskan Road, Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR weather.
Highs level off around 27 today under partly cloudy skies. Winds out of the northeast around 5 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 11 tonight, partly cloudy. Highs around 25 tomorrow, partly cloudy skies. Cloudy skies Saturday with highs around 41. 38 Sunday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK and tell us what's on your mind about firearms today. I'm just about to read some quotes that I think are negative about how firearms are handled on stage, and then the last quote I read will be one I think is correct, and I'll point that one out to you. So this is a quote from film and prop historian Michael Corey. Quote, "The person responsible for loading and ensuring that the firearm is ready for the scene is called an armorer or weapons master." And I wish they wouldn't use the word weapons, but I'm quoting, so that's what I need to use. "And you're supposed to have an armorer or an assistant armorer. And there are several steps that you're supposed to go through to ensure that a weapon is loaded correctly and with correct type of blanks," Corey explained. "Because there's more than one type of blank, there's a lower power, and then a mid power, and then a high powered blank, and they all create different visual effects. Before the actor is given a weapon, it's supposed to go through several stages of safety before it's handed to the actor. And the actor has to entrust, that's what I disagree with, entrust that the armorer and everyone else involved have done their job correctly before handing the weapon to the actor," he continued. "Armorer is a fairly new position in the history of film production, going back only to the 1980s. Before that, the prop master handled everything. Recently, it's become more common to enlist specialists. The weapons master or armorer is required to be on set whenever a weapon is being used. The Actors Equity Association's guidelines state, before each use, make sure the gun has been test fired off stage and then ask to test fire it yourself. Watch the prop master check the cylinders and barrel to be sure no foreign object or dummy bullet has been lodged inside. Further, all loading of firearms must be done by the property manager, armorer, or experienced persons working under direct supervision," unquote. How about the person that's actually going to use the gun? And a little more, quote, "A prop firearm should apply to anything from a rubber toy to a real firearm that can fire a projectile. However, if it's used for firing even just blanks, it's considered a real gun. A blank is a type of gun cartridge that contains gunpowder, but no bullet. Still, it can seriously hurt or kill someone who is close by, according to the Actors Equity Association," unquote. And here is a quote from Sean Mastin. He's a retired Navy SEAL who has worked with actors on the CBS drama SEAL Team, and I like the way he thinks. Quote, "The chain of custody is extremely serious in regard to weapons on set. You've got to teach people barrel discipline. I mean, things you teach a basic person who is going to be using a firearm. Mattson continued, so anytime someone hands me a weapon, even if they tell me it's unloaded, the first thing I do is check to make sure it's unloaded. And I'll pull out the magazine and get a visual check day or night to make sure that it's actually clear. And I know 100% without a shadow of a doubt, I know the condition of that weapon. It's that critical, unquote. And I concur with how that person thinks. And this is a quote from Stephen Gutowski, who is a firearms reporter and gun safety instructor. Quote, safety protocols on set were not followed. That's abundantly clear at this point. And I think that's the main takeaway of this whole situation, is that guns, even prop guns, aren't toys. And if you're going to use them, especially in a professional capacity like on a movie set, you need to be trained how to use them, and you need to follow the safety rules at all times, unquote. Now, all the quotes I just read were from a Fox News article published October 21st titled Alec Baldwin's Fatal Prop Gun Shooting: Experts Weigh In on How Accident Happened. And here are some quotes from a New York Post article dated October 23rd. Alec Baldwin ignored the number one rule of gun safety. Quote, Alec Baldwin, who accidentally killed his cinematographer on the set of his film Rust, should have never pointed a gun at another human. Even if he believed it was safe, Hollywood safety experts told the Post, loaded or unloaded, a weapon never gets pointed at another human being, unquote. Now, Hollywood firearms consultant Bryant Carpenter of Dark 30 Film Services told the Post, for safety, all live firearms used in TV and film productions are typically aimed at a dummy point, not at equipment, cast, or crew, Carpenter noted. Guns, he said, are never aimed at a person, unquote. And another quote, former filmmaker and former U.S. National Shooting Team member Peter Lake put the blame on Baldwin. The buck stops with Alec Baldwin on every level, he told the Post, unquote. And there is a lot of speculation about live rounds and rules not being followed. Apparently, the film crew had not yet retreated to what they call a video village, an area set up for crew to watch from a distance. And we'll all just have to wait until discovery is complete to find out what really happened. The point in this conversation is that no matter what anyone else says and whether they clear the gun before handing it to you, it's your responsibility to check that gun and make sure it's empty and make sure what you load into it is correct for that gun in the way it is being used. And it's your responsibility never to point a gun, prop or real, at any person. And one more thing, if you run into a person who continually pushes the anti-gun conversation, saying that guns are unsafe, just ask them if they've ever taken a gun safety course. And if they say no, then say, well, what if you took a gun safety course and found out guns were safe? What would you do then? And that is the end of that discussion. Before I get into National Chocolate Day and war, I want to talk a little bit about Chuck DeReden. Now, I've mentioned him before. He's a gentleman in town, Chuck DeReden, who runs C4 Training Group. It's C4 Training Group, LLC. And C4 stands for Comprehensive, Conscientious Training with Commitment and Clarity. And Chuck DeReden and his wife, Cynthia, combine their talents to provide their students with what I think is some of the best training in Fairbanks. Chuck spent 24 years in the U.S. Army Infantry. And I don't think Chuck would mind if I repeated a sentence from his website about his background. In the Army, Chuck has served as a sniper, team leader, squad leader, platoon sergeant, battalion's operations sergeant, battalion master gunner, company first sergeant, and combat division master gunner. He has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and a master's in education. And he's currently in his second career as a sergeant with the Alaska State Troopers. And you can find a longer list of Chuck's credentials and training on his website, c4traininggroup.com. That's just the letter C, the number 4, traininggroup.com, under Who We Are. Just keep scrolling down that page. Now, with all the experience Chuck has behind him, I personally believe that Chuck is probably one of, if not the most qualified firearms instructor in Fairbanks, if not the state of Alaska. And he has stepped up to provide classes that no one else is offering locally. So you have to pay a lot of money to fly out and take this level of training at some of the well-known ranges in the lower 48. So, folks, you can get this training right here from Chuck, and he's been doing this now a few years. Chuck offers the Alaska Concealed Handgun Permit class, and that would serve as your basic gun safety class, too. He teaches NRA Concealed Carry curriculum, and that meets the state's requirements for a permit. For the first few years I taught concealed carry classes, Chuck provided the two-hour law lecture for my classes, and many of you listeners who took classes from me may remember Chuck. His presentations are riveting, and he often discusses real-life examples to drive the points home. He also offers defensive handgun level 1 classes, and that class is then a prerequisite to his defensive handgun level 2 class. And I got a lot of requests from my students for holster training. How do you draw from your holster safely? How do you safely reholster? We can't teach holster work at the fish and game range, but Chuck teaches proper holster drawing and reholstering at his class, which is classes which are held at the TVSA in the winter and then outdoors in the summer. So go to his C4TrainingGroup.com website and read what is included in his Defensive Handgun 1 and Defensive Handgun 2 courses. And think about it. You're taking defensive handgun classes from someone who has deep military training and is currently a state trooper. He's also an NRA training counselor. So if you have any questions at all about the proper methods you can use to defend yourself and the safest way to handle your firearm when doing so, Chuck can teach you that. Another great class Chuck teaches is an Advanced Skills Urban Rifle course. And where else can you get an advanced skills class like that in Fairbanks? Just from Chuck. So more information aside from his website. Chuck is happy to take your phone calls. His phone number is 844-966-4079. That's 844-966-4079. And just briefly about his schedule, you can find what his class schedule is on his website under course calendar. He does have a Defensive Handgun 1 class coming up November 13th and 14th, so that's just in 2 weeks. You might want to look into that. He's got some concealed carry classes scheduled every month, and he's got a number of future dates on his website, so just take a look at those. And I'm giving him a reference. I have worked with Chuck. I think he teaches an absolutely great class. Comprehensive, conscientious training with commitment and clarity, and he very much does that. So let's get started on our next topic. I'll get started here, and then we'll break, and I'll finish up. Today, October 28th, is National Chocolate Day. So let's talk about chocolate and war. How's that? Are there any listeners who have eaten World War II chocolate rations, the D rations? If you have, call in and let us know your description of how they tasted. I have never tasted one. And we should all call this segment Chocolate in War, Sabotage, and Camouflage. And yes, there is Military History of Chocolate. Now, an article titled Victory by Chocolate in Legion magazine says that during the French and Indian War, that's 1754 to 1763, Benjamin Franklin was a quartermaster procuring supplies for the British troops. And Franklin requisitioned 6 pounds of chocolate, which was hard to get in those days, per officer as a form of compensation for them. And from the History.com website, I learned that during the Revolutionary War, so that's moving forward to 1775 to 1783, chocolate, which was a famous favorite treat of George Washington, became part of his soldiers' rations. It had a kick of caffeine and sugar, and that was needed to fuel the troops. So chocolate was also used as occasional payment to American troops in lieu of money. In the Revolutionary War days, according to the History.com article titled World War I 1920s Chocolate Candy Boom, during the Revolutionary War, chocolate was also considered a medical supply. And here's a quote from that Legion magazine article. Chocolate was, quote, so valued that in 1780, Dr. James Mann, a Continental Army surgeon, sent a desperate letter to the military hospital in Danbury, Connecticut, requesting a pound of chocolate for the use of the wounded men at his place, unquote. But there's more. Chocolate candy also played a role in the Civil War. And we're going to go to break, and we'll talk about chocolate in the Civil War at the other side.
Mark Levin. Don't miss the Mark Levin Show weekdays from 3 to 6 right here.
Fox News, I'm Rich Dennison. President Biden went to the Capitol building today with a framework agreement on his social spending bill.
House Democrats are now trying to figure out if they have the votes to move forward on a separate infrastructure measure advanced weeks ago in the 50-50 Senate. Several progressive Democrats insist they need more than just a framework on that larger spending plan before they will vote in favor of the infrastructure measure.
Fox's Jared Halpern on Capitol Hill. An American Airlines flight from New York to California diverted to Denver yesterday after officials say a passenger struck a flight attendant during a dispute over mask requirements.
American Airlines saying that it's outraged the FBI is investigating. The incident happening just as the FAA says that unruly behavior in the skies has declined slightly over the past week.
Fox's Jeff Manasso. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
Alaska's news source reports the Anchorage Mushing District coordinators are making strides in their efforts to bring history to light and help tourists better understand the significance of the area of 4th Avenue and D Street. Coordinators recently unveiled bronze paws and husky sidewalk inlays. They are some of the first tangible pieces of the project that people can now see. The decorations are part of an effort to get donations. Each one has a name etched in it, allowing people to leave a piece of themselves in downtown Anchorage. It is a place in the sidewalk that could be here for years, years, and years to come, said John McCleary, Fur Rendezvous Executive Director. The Anchorage Mushing District project is an extension of the Fur Rendezvous operations. The new inlays are each a paw toward the finish line. Now we have something that people can see, they can read, not just read a brochure or listen to our visions in presentations, McCleary said. Now they can come down here and actually see that we truly are working towards creating the Mushing District. Organizers are hoping to have this project finish late next year or in early 2023. Fundraising, they say, is really what is needed.
Streaming
now.
Live online at KFAR660.com.
Now that we're once again in the Great Frozen North, it's time to stay warm and be prepared for the elements. Being prepared was ingrained in me at a very early age, and Auto Trim Design can help you be prepared too. With auto starts to warm your car, heated seats to warm your buns, moose lights to show you the way, mud flaps and floor mats to protect your rig, running boards to make getting in and out of your truck less tedious, and much, much more. Get prepared today at Auto Trim Design.
As we always say, we will be here when the other guys are gone.
When you've driven enough winters in Alaska, you learn about keeping up with your vehicle's maintenance. Let Rogers Auto Repair help. From tune-ups to winterizing, Rogers is your complete auto shop. Even engine and transmission rebuilds are done right there. They're still helping folks from the same location near the airport on Dale Road since they opened in 1967. Depend on the people with experience and a sound reputation. Family-owned and operated Rogers Auto Repair. Call 479-6665. Be their next satisfied customer. Rogers Auto Repair.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255, 458-TALK, and what is on your mind about firearms today. And before I get started back on the chocolate, I want to re-remind you about the Hockey Club Fairbanks Gun Raffle. Call Maria at 907-378-6084. $20 a ticket. And Melissa, what was that gun that can read?
It is a Ruger Precision Rifle 300 Winchester Magnum.
Great. We all want one of those. So
yes,
let's support the young hockey players. Okay. And we have some hockey players that actually are in our youth rifle team, too. So all these kids are doing good things to become responsible adults. All right. So I'm going to quote here about chocolate. It was used as a provision with quick energy and lots of sugar, according to Steve Allman, who wrote Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. And I read the first chocolate bar was created by Joseph Fry, who lived in Great Britain in 1847. And 21 years later, in 1868, Cadbury began selling individual boxes of chocolate candies. Tins of chocolate were popular at the turn of the century during the South African War called the Second Boer War or the Anglo-Boer War, fought from 1899 to 1902. And Queen Victoria herself sent Canadian and other Empire soldiers fighting that Second Boer War commemorative tins of chocolate. And each tin contained 1 pound of chocolate, and as many as 80,000 of them had the royal visage, that's her face, and were inscribed with South Africa 1900, and I wish you a happy new year, Victoria, R.I. And R.I. is Regina Imperatrix, which means Queen Empress. Okay, so I had to look that one up. And here's a quote from Legion magazine. I have just received a box of chocolate, Her Majesty's present to the South African soldiers, wrote Canadian Private C. Jackson to his father in December of 1899. There's such a demand for them by the officers and everybody else as memento. In fact, I have been offered 5 pounds for mine, and at the Cape, as much as 10 pounds is being paid, unquote. But it was war, the outbreak of war on a global scale, the world wars, that caused the chocolate candy bar to skyrocket. In World War I, the British military gave its soldiers chocolate to boost morale and energy, and the mayor of York sent a tin of hometown Roundtree's chocolates to residents in uniform. In 1915, every United Kingdom soldier abroad received a King George chocolate tin. And of course, we Americans were not to be outdone in the sweet department. Quote, the American Army Quartermaster Corps solicited donations of 20-pound blocks of chocolate from confectioners back home, which they cut down and wrapped by hand. When USGIs returned from the war with an insatiable appetite for chocolate, they arrived back just before the onset of Prohibition. When Americans actively sought alternatives to alcohol to boost their energy and mood, from soda to ice cream to candy, by the end of the 1920s, more than 40,000 different candy bars were being made in the United States. Says Susan Benjamin, candy historian and author of Sweetest Sin, The Unwrapped Story of How Candy Became America's Favorite Pleasure, unquote. And there are many more stories of chocolate and wars, but not all was fun and games with the chocolate bars. Our enemies thought to camouflage chocolate bars for sabotage. And this is from another History.com article titled Nazis Plan to Kill Winston Churchill with an Exploding Chocolate Bar by Christopher Klein. Quote, when Nazi Germany rained conventional bombs upon Britain in World War II, Adolf Hitler's forces were also busy at work dividing fiendishly clever booby traps to strike the enemy on its own soil. As the war progressed, British intelligence agency MI5 learned of a secret Nazi sabotage campaign to hide explosives in everyday items such as cans of plums, canisters of motor oil, shaving brushes, and lumps of coal. The spy agency even discovered Nazi plans to develop bangers and match that delivered a true bang. And in the spring of 1943, MI5 operative Victor Rothschild learned of an even more ingenious bomb being conjured up by the Nazis, an exploding chocolate bar, unquote. And here's more to make you a little nervous when you unwrap your next chocolate bar. Quote, the killer bar was cloaked in a black foil wrapper with gold lettering bearing the name Peter's Chocolate. Underneath the real chocolate exterior was steel and canvas, and when a piece of chocolate at the end of the bar was broken off, the canvas pulled. It activated a bomb that would explode after a 7-second delay. and MI5 believed Nazi secret agents were plotting to smuggle the explosive chocolate into the War Cabinet and into the hands of Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who was known to have a sweet tooth, unquote. And from Wikipedia, none of the chocolate bars reached Britain, but British authorities did capture some in places as far away as Turkey. So how do we know this? It was the spring of 1943, and Victor Rothschild, who was then an MI5 operative, learned of the Nazi exploding chocolate bar. And Victor Rothschild was a trained biologist, and he was a member of the Rothschild banking family. And he led MI5's three-person explosives and counter-sabotage unit. Someone needed to draw sketches of Nazi devices so they could be used by intelligence officers to defuse bombs. They didn't have computers to do that in those days. So Rothschild himself was not an artist, but one of his colleagues, Donald Fish, had a son who was. So Lawrence Fish was employed by MI5 to draw detailed freehand drawings of a number of Nazi booby trap bombs. Quote, "When Rothschild learned of the stealth candy bomb, he again turned to Fish. I wonder if you could do a drawing for me of an explosive slab of chocolate," Rothschild wrote to Fish on May 4, 1943, from a secret bunker deep underneath the streets of London. The MI5 counter-sabotage agent included a rough sketch of the bomb, which he wanted Fish to improve upon. "Would it be possible for you to do a drawing of this, one possibly with the paper half taken off, revealing one end, and the other with the piece broken off, showing the canvas?" Unquote. Many years later, that letter from Rothschild to Fish was discovered by Fish's widow as she went through her deceased husband's belongings in 2009. He had died at the age of 89. So the letter revealed the history, but no one knew where the drawings were. And they were presumed lost, along with many other drawings of Nazi deceptive devices. But in 2015, a sheaf of more than two dozen of Fish's drawings were rediscovered by the Rothschilds family. And as they cleaned out a chest of drawers in their family house in Suffolk, England, a quarter of a century after Rothschild's death. And about the sheaf of drawings, quote, "Some of the explosive devices depicted in Fish's newly rediscovered drawings appear to have been ripped from the pages of one of Ian Fleming's James Bond novels. There are bombs concealed inside matchboxes, pocket watches, and even thermos flasks." One sketch shows the Nazis had developed a plan for a simple culinary timing mechanism in which dried peas in a test tube would expand as they absorbed water, forcing a floating cork to rise until two brass screws touched to complete a circuit, unquote. And for those of you who are not into chocolate bars but would rather eat M&Ms, those were inspired by rations given to soldiers during the Spanish Civil War. Quote, "In 1932, after a falling out with his father and business partner, Forrest Mars Sr. of the Mars Candy Company moved to England, where he began manufacturing Mars bars for troops. It was during the Spanish Civil War that Mars purportedly encountered British volunteers eating small chocolate beads encased in a hard sugar shell, which prevented melting. In an age when sales of chocolate typically dropped off during summer months due to the lack of air conditioning, Mars was thrilled by the prospect of developing a product that would be able to resist melting at high temperatures," unquote. And about 9 years later, in March of 1941, Mr. Mars received a patent for his M&M manufacturing process and began productions. And M&Ms were originally sold in cardboard tubes in pretty much the same colors as today, red, brown, orange, yellow, green, and violet coatings. And when the United States entered World War II, the M&Ms were exclusively sold to the military, and that enabled heat-resistant and easy-to-transport chocolate to be included in our American troops' rations. And like the chocolate bars, by the time the war was over and our American soldiers returned home, they were hooked on M&Ms. And just a little bit more about the M on the M&M. Just after World War II, wartime quotas ended and the M&Ms were made available to the public. The dark brown bag that M&Ms comes in today was introduced in 1948. 2 years after that, in 1950, each candy was imprinted with a black M. And 4 years later, in 1954, that black M was changed to a white M. And the advertisements told the public, look for the M on every piece to make sure they were getting the real thing. And one more thing for our health-conscious M&M eaters, there were no red M&Ms between 1976 and 1987 because we thought red number 2 caused cancer and other awful things, and red dye number 2 was banned, and actually M&Ms never used red dye number 2, but the public panicked. In 1987, our studies showed that that dye was not carcinogenic, so enjoy your chocolate, enjoy your M&Ms, and remember the role it played in our world wars and keeping our soldiers fueled and well snacked. And we're gonna go to break.
Out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only thing to guide you is an evening star. The roughest, toughest man by far was Ragtime Cowboy Joe. He got his name from singing to the cows and sheep. Every night they say he sings a herd to sleep in a bass voice rich and deep, crooning soft and low.
He always sings raggedy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in his saddle.
Now that we're once again in the great frozen north, it's time to stay warm and be prepared for the elements. Being prepared was ingrained in me at a very early age, and Auto Trim Design can help you be prepared too. With auto starts to warm your car, heated seats to warm your buns, moose lights to show you the way, mud flaps and floor mats to protect your rig, running boards to make getting in and out of your truck less tedious, and much, much more. Get prepared today at Auto Trim Design.
As we always say, we will be here when the other guys are gone.
Fall and winter in Alaska bring new sporting opportunities. Grouse, ptarmigan, and other small game hunting. Snowshoeing and winter camping. Predator calling and trapping. Gear up with Frontier Outfitters and prepare to succeed. Traps, snares, and calls. Guns and ammunition. Stay warm and dry with the right clothing. Rest easy with tents, sleeping bags, and camp necessities. ATV and snow machine accessories are just downstairs at Century Hardware. Alaska is new every season. And for every season, there's Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
Arctic RV will be closed beginning November 24th and will reopen April 4th this spring. So book your shop appointments now. Your ATV and snow machine hauling trailers will be ready to roll for the season and ready for pickup on or before November 23rd. From wheel bearings to wiring to propane appliances and lights, have them all repaired at Arctic RV. Need parts? Shop Arctic RV's huge parts inventory. Get out and play with Arctic RV at 30th and Pegger Road.
Weather brought to you by the Great Harvest Bread Company, your local bakery cafe in the Bentley Mall Annex on College Road. Fresh breads, treats, and great gift ideas.
KFAR weather.
Highs level off around 27 today under partly cloudy skies. Winds out of the northeast around 5 miles per hour. Lows dip down to about 11 tonight, partly cloudy. Highs around 25 tomorrow, partly cloudy skies. Cloudy skies Saturday with highs around 41. 38 Sunday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 19 degrees.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in at 458-8255. 458 Talk and tell us what's on your mind about firearms today, and if you ever ate one of those World War II ration chocolate bars, what did they taste like? So I'm going to talk about the Remington Ammunition Company and Vista Outdoors, and I'm probably not going to have time to finish it, so I've got a whole list of things that I haven't finished over the last couple weeks, and I'll do that next week. So on this day in 1793, Eliphalet Fallet Remington, who founded Remington Arms, was born. And the November 2021 issue of Guns and Ammo magazine had an article about Remington Ammunition, and I want to share from that article. It's entitled Remington Ammunition is Back, Big Green for the Win. It's by Alfredo Rico. And the current Remington has been inviting select media to tour its factory and learn about its plants and its plans for moving forward in the future. And Guns and Ammo magazine sent the author, Rico, to visit Remington's plant in, I think it's Lanoke. It's either Lanoke or Lanoke. I'll call it Lanoke. Lanoke, Arkansas, and talk with its long-term employees. And I will get to that part in a minute. But first, I want to provide some Remington background taken from the article. And most of you know that Remington has gone through at least two previous bankruptcies and survived. And the latest bankruptcy resulted in Remington's assets being split up and sold. Now, Vista Outdoor Company purchased the Remington Ammunition Plant and the Remington name in 2020. Vista Outdoors has an interest in keeping Remington's reputation. They are not a private equity firm that drains cash from operations and then sells the remaining assets. And that's some consolidation to Remington fans and their long-term employees. But the questions still exist. And one of the main ones is, what will happen to Remington Ammunition, fondly called Big Green? Considering that Vista Outdoor also owns Federal Ammunition and CCI Ammunition. Will the brands retain their separate brand names and associated qualities, or will the Remington Ammunition plant be absorbed and lose its unique place in our ammunition market? And here's a brief history, very brief. The author states that the name Remington is one of the most recognizable brands in the world. He points out that Remington Ammunition Company is often lumped in with the rest of the Remington enterprise, like firearms side of the business. And his thinking is that the ammunition side of Remington deserves its own focus of importance. The original company named Remington Ammunition Works was established in 1871. And by 1912, Remington Ammunition Works had merged with the Union Metallic Cartridge Company. And Union Metallic Cartridge Company at the time was one of the largest ammunition manufacturers in the United States. And you've probably seen or purchased boxes with Remington-UMC printed on them. And today, Remington UMC ammunition is made in the same location as Remington's other manufacturing facilities in Lonoke, Arkansas. At one time, Remington UMC had manufacturing plants in Connecticut, New Jersey, Canada, and England. And then in 1933, Remington acquired Peters Ammunition, and they made the blue paper shot shells that were popular at the time. The head stamp was RP for Remington Peters. I have never personally seen one, but maybe some of you have. And during World War II, Remington added 5 temporary ammunition manufacturing facilities. They supplied half of the small arms ammunitions to the Allies. And then in 1970, Remington moved its ammunition manufacturing facilities from Bridgeport, Connecticut to today's location in Arkansas. Now, Rico writes that Remington Ammunition has always been innovative. Quote, it introduced the concept of game load to shotgun hunters and developed the clean bore primer that reduced fouling, rust, and corrosion. It was the first company to use plastic hull for shot shells. On the rifle side, it developed the core-locked bullet, which is the original controlled expansion bullet, and a design still in use today, 82 years later. Remington is also responsible for the 300 Remington Ultra Magnum, the RUM, the 300 Short Action Ultra Magnum, the SAUM, and the 7mm SAUM, unquote. Now, Rico points out that through its 150-year history, Remington has been sold many times. However, despite the company's ups and downs, Remington has always been regarded as a producer of quality firearms and ammunition. When Vista Outdoor purchased Remington's ammunition plant, their accessories business, and the rights to the Remington brand and trademark, they did not purchase the Remington Arms Division. And this is the list of who bought what. Vista Outdoor bought the Lonoke-based ammunitions business and other assets. Round Hill Group, LLC, that's a property management company, bought everything firearms related that is non-Marlin. So apparently the 870s will continue to be made through Round Hill's holding. Sierra Bullets bought Barnes Ammunitions. Sturm Ruger and Company bought the Marlin Firearms portion. JJE Capital Holdings got DPMS, H&R, Storm Lake, AAC, and Parker brands. Franklin Armory Holdings got the Bushmaster brand and some related assets. And the Sportsman's Warehouse won the Tapco brands, and that's an American-made aftermarket firearms parts and accessories manufacturer. So back to the article on Remington Ammunition, its future, and the thoughts of long-term employees. The author Rico writes that Remington's previous owners left a bad taste in the mouth of their employees. The purchase by Vista Outdoor, Inc. and the transition has led these employees actually to sigh relief. Quote, Remington's pride is intact and they're on track to become stronger than ever, unquote. With its large red-sided manufacturing building visible from Interstate 40 and the factory Remington sign outside, The Lonoke Ammunition Plant is an iconic landmark for those living in the area. Quote, "It's not just a big green sign, though. Hunting and waterfowl shooting are ingrained in the local culture. To them, grabbing a green box of ammunition is more than choosing a brand. It's about supporting your home, team, and community." Enrico says Remington brand is interwoven in America's culture. Quote, "There are two ammunition production buildings on the 1,200 acres. The original red brick building has 750,000 square feet of manufacturing space, and this is where everything from rimfire, centerfire, to shot shells are made. Starting with raw materials, all of the components except gunpowder are made here. This includes primers, brass cases, bullets, and shotgun shells," unquote. Enrico says that entering the original factory was like being transported in time. The old building still has that 1960s industrial architecture, exposed and riveted beams, sheet metal siding, and caked on paint layered on 50-year-old machinery. Now, the Ely plant, which is the second plant, is named after Remington's founder, L.A. Fallett Remington. Quote, "It is the epitome of modern manufacturing technology and efficiency," unquote. And the Ely plant is dedicated solely to the manufacture of 9mm ammunition. Rico writes that the interior features bright lights from wall to wall, the floors are immaculate, and there are fewer machines and a more streamlined workflow, thus fewer people are needed to run the line. And one of my favorite quotes these days is by Arthur L.P. Hartley from his 1953 article, The Go-Betweens. And the quote is, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." And that quote really has nothing to do with Remington, but I like it because it can be used for so many situations. And the present-day invigorated view of old-time Remington employees fits this quote. Rico titles the section of the article that highlights the old-time Remington employees as "That Was Then." And these were employees that lived and worked through Remington's ups and downs through the years. Quote, "Remington's bankruptcies were due to the ownership's financial maneuvers and not the fault of the facilities or staff. The staff at each Remington plant knew how to make quality firearms and ammunition, but the leadership couldn't outrun the debt that was run up during the booming times, and this resulted in cost-cutting measures that ultimately affected the quality and output of the products, which only accelerated how fast the Remington brand went under," unquote. And more, here's another quote, and I like this one. "The discussions I had with ammunition staff made it clear how desperate things had become. To cut costs with the ammunition plant, management even considered abandoning the iconic green and yellow packaging for plain white boxes, like those containing light bulbs. The disconnect between the efficiency consultants and the firearms product was scarily apparent when one of the consultants asked, 'Why don't you just put less powder in the shell?'" Unquote. And another sad move by Remington management back then was that they did not see the value in their Remington Gun Club. And that was a trap and skeet facility that was located on the Remington property. That club was open to the public, and at the time it hosted the largest youth program in the country. And I did not know that until I read this article. Apparently more than 5,000 youths attended the youth shooting program in May and July each year. And the Remington executives shut the program down. And I think that was a bad move because it's the youth that makes up the next generation of firearms users, and they are the ones that would purchase Remington products. When Vista Outdoor purchased the Remington assets, they reopened the range and programs, and now it also includes sporting clays. So that was then, and the next section is "This Is Now, Remington's History in the Past." And quote, "Vista Outdoor retained enough former talent and its vested interest in keeping Remington ammunition alive and well," unquote. One of Remington's employees interviewed Dwayne. His name was Dwayne Welch, and he's a research and development technician with a long career at the plant. And he has a reputation as a troubleshooter. He's the go-to guy to make a product better. And Welch has been with Remington for 32 years. His wife worked at the plant for 28 years. His father and mother both retired from the Remington ammunition plant, and his grandfather helped build the factory. And I'm going to stop now. I'm going to finish this next week because these quotes from these old-time employees are precious. I want to wish you all a great weekend, and I will be back with you next Thursday.
This has been Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio. Brought to you by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. To listen back to this or past episodes of Shooter's Corner, go to KFARradio.com and click on the archives page. For more Shooter's Corner on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.